on this summer that we can celebrate. And Ben is very much involved in so many different ways in the community, where he's using his gifts, his abilities. He's also working at New Heights throughout the summer, so it's been just awesome to work alongside of him. He's truly a person that I'm learning from, and I appreciate his example. When I think of Ben, I think of the words in Timothy that I used to quote to myself 40 years ago. Do not be despised in your youth, but set an example for the believers in faith and speech and in love. And that is Ben. When I think of somebody that's an example of faith and love and truth and just living out his faith, that's Ben. So let's give our ears and our hearts to what God has given Ben to say. Come on up, I want to pray for him as he presents the message that God's given him. Thanks, Lord, for Ben. I thank you for the way that you've called him to be your servant, to be your follower, and to use his gifts and abilities to bless others. And I know today that you have something that you have for him to say to this community. May we be all ears, and may our hearts be open to what you want to say to us in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks, God. Just a second to get myself organized here. Wind is actually something. So I heard a story recently that left an indelible mark on my memory. Nice word, yeah. It's a good one. It was about an author staying at his friend's house. This author was he was well known. He was staying at it was a family friend, someone who appreciated his work, his writing, and he was there for the day. They had dinner and they had some kids. And they went to sleep, and there was a 3-year-old boy in the family. So everybody's in bed, except the 3-year-old boy in the middle of the night gets up, and he's on a mission. He goes to his parents' room. He knocks on the door, and his parents shoo him away, and they say, John, get back to bed. But the boy is shameless and unconscious that it's 3 a.m., and he goes and knocks on his guest's door. And the guest opens up the door. He looks down. And he's like rubbing his eyes because it's the middle of the night. He looks down at little John and he says, "Hi, John. I'm delighted to see you." And John, with a certain glare and this shameless audacity, he looks up at him and he says, "Where's the cookies?" I've been at a camp this week. A few of us here, actually, Annika, myself, Mr. A. And it is filled with kids that are like this, shamelessly audactic kids. They say and do unmentionable things at a pace that's relentless, and really unmentionable things. I won't say some of them up here. But all while, I can't help but being endeared by it. Yeah, it's pretty funny, eh? That's okay. I can't help but being endeared by these kids' shameless audacity, because they freely expose what's happening in their mind or world, whether it's something that they're happy, curious, mad, sad, or even terrified about, and are open about hearing feedback about whatever it is. And I so enjoy interacting with these kids and watching how they move about camp, relating to each other and the leaders. In the school we're at, which is at Mission Central, throughout the school they have these words written all over the walls. Some of them say, build your future, or persevere, or work hard. And I read one that was written in big, bold, blue writing, and it said, defeat the unthinkable. And it caught my eye. It's funny how such profound and insightful comments that can be so necessary for adults too are found in these environments at elementary schools. Anyways, this quote, defeat the unthinkables, it caught my eye. Typically it wouldn't have. I would have just thought it's a part of this whole learning kind of environment. But it did. And I think it did so because in my attempt to address some of my lifestyle habits and choices that were predominantly during being a teenager, I feel like I'm having to address a lot of things lately that feel like unthinkables to bring up in my attempt to go back to operating like these kids at this camp. And I think this posture of being open to learn doesn't seem to just happen in a snap. It's a learning process that likely at times feels like math equations and learning how to write paragraphs. I think we have an awesome example set by kids, demonstrating to us characteristics that can be so tough to grasp when we choose to be adults or grown-ups. So today, in answering the question that these last 10-ish weeks have been about, what difference has Jesus made in my life? I'm telling my narrative and others that inspired me on how Jesus broke through into my unthinkables, my reality, my real insecurity, the things that bother me and hurt me, showing me my potential and unleashing me on a journey into my potential. I'm suggesting that Jesus can defeat our unthinkables by chucking a wrench, so to say, into our fears that limit us by showing us our potential. Thanks, Rob. So I was with a couple friends a few weeks ago, and we were hanging out, and we were on a side of a hill. There was three of us, and we were just kind of chatting about our community and the exciting things that were happening in it. And my one friend made the comment that just it stuck in my memory. I didn't seem to forget it. It kept coming back. And she said, "There's these things in life that come up." In her life, and in thinking about them, they inspire so much terror if she was to deal with them, that they were so revolving around fear, and that she acknowledges it's there, and she puts it back on the shelf because how do you deal with these things? And then 3 months later, it appears again just to show up and be bothersome and terribly confusing. And probably even if, like, I think of even my own life and some of those moments, in dealing with them, I'm scared about what will happen if I actually deal with them. I think the story of Zacchaeus the tax collector is an antidote to break through these unthinkables, or is my suggested antidote to break through these unthinkables. You'll find it in your bulletin, the story of Zacchaeus, on the right-hand side. I just got to switch these papers, which is a bit of a thing with all these clips. So it starts, it says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. And I'm just going to be making some points or insights that I've noticed and heard other speakers comment on. This story has held a lot of weight in my life, so I really like it. So just in that first verse, it says, I'm saying that Jesus had been performing miracles which drew a crowd behind him. Through his journey, he seemed to leave an impression on people through a word, a look, a glance, or a touch that never had them leaving the same as when they first arrived. Verse 2, a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was the chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he couldn't see over the crowd. I think it's good to note the reality of someone in this time and in culture. Some people describe Zacchaeus as the runt who built an ivory tower out of stolen money. Tax collectors were those who partnered with the Roman Empire to collect taxes from their own people to get a kickback from the take. They were allegedly excommunicated from their family, exiled from being with them, which was a big deal in the Jewish community, because oftentimes the families would be very interconnected, and I think they would even operate in a business together. So to be excommunicated and exiled from that, so much so that you're not even allowed to eat dinner with your family or go to the synagogue, was a pretty significant thing. And I imagine Zacchaeus, this Jewish person, could as smart, because I think to be a tax collector, you got to be kind of on point, on the ball. Selfish, probably, maybe a little self-absorbed. Someone who people, I think, would love to hate. And but also, I think he might be probably sad and broken and lonely. Verse 4, so he ran ahead and climbed the sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming up that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. This is also quite significant. The one who is attracting the crowd is now asking to stay at his house, the one who everyone loves to hate, asking to eat with him, asking to enter into friendship with him when no one else would. This community does not accept Zacchaeus the tax collector. However, Jesus is stepping out to saying, can I come to your house, eat food with you, and enter into friendship with you? So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be a guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor, and if I cheated anybody out of anything, I'll pay them back four times the amount. Zacchaeus, so enticed by Jesus, effortlessly blubbers, exposing what he knows is wrong and is affecting how he feels about life, himself, and others in this interaction with Jesus. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because this man, too, son of Abraham, for the Son of God came to seek to save the lost. What I'm curious about is what happened in that short interaction that allowed Jesus to jump down from the tree, ditch everything he had made for himself, and follow after Jesus. Like, how that does not just happen, that your life changes within one interaction of meeting someone. I'm suggesting that Jesus looked at him in the tree, looking up at, imagine Zacchaeus is like in this gazebo or something, but if the gazebo was made out of sycamore tree, Zacchaeus is up there, Jesus looks at him, Zacchaeus looks back down, and in seeing how Jesus saw him, and for a moment, Zacchaeus saw himself in the same light of how Jesus saw him. And I think this is kind of what Zacchaeus saw. He saw how much of a delight he was to Jesus. He saw how non-judgmental Jesus was of him, despite his reality. He saw how Jesus overlooked his self-absorption with just effortlessly. And I think this interaction was similar as if a loving father was looking at his son. Then they went back to Zacchaeus' house to talk and process the ways that he's been hurt, or that he hurts and has been hurt, his insecurities, his dreams maybe, his failures, his future, and how Jesus has always been in his corner and intends to be. I think Jesus looked at him, believed in what he could become, affirmed him, which then changed the whole direction of his life. And apparently the story with Zacchaeus is that he went on to be the author of the first gospel, Matthew, that something actually did happen in Zacchaeus' life that it substantiated to a different life. I think an alternative way of looking at this passage is also, I think, it can be an interaction or a narrative that can take place in our own minds where we're kind of the characters in a very unconscious and kind of mundane way. How I understood this story when I first heard it, actually, I wasn't reading it, I heard someone talk about it, was that I instantly related my reality at the time of that of the reality of Zacchaeus, a reality of fear that kept me feeling low, self-absorbed, insecure, small, and limited. The muttering self-righteous folks in the story, those were kind of my bad thoughts. The ones that facilitated and first created the fear in the first place. And Jesus then spoke to me, Ben or Zacchaeus, in a way that broke through that reality, telling me who I really was, how valued I was to him, how much of a treat I was to him, exposing the truth of my potential, and in a protective way, urged me compassionately to persist in listening to his voice and recognizing the mutterers, the people that were just shooting stuff at him as lies, that it's junk, don't trust that. Begin to trust what I have to say. This is the chuck your wrench in your fear I'm talking about. The one that ends the destructive cycle of how fear can manifest and ferment unleashing us into our own potential, giving the guts to do whatever it takes to be a child, once again, returning back to this reality of those kids that were at that school that are shamelessly autistic. I heard another story online. I really enjoy stories that I don't think I'll ever be able to forget. I went back and listened to it just like tons of times, like about more than 10 times. And every time I listened to it, I seemed to be affected by it. Anyways, an author who worked at a university that a guy named Larry Mullaney went to in Philadelphia tells it. He speaks of Larry Mullaney as someone who he has yet to have met who hated himself more. He speaks of Larry Mullaney as someone who had low self-esteem, who doesn't have a hint of contempt he had, someone who has low self-esteem and doesn't have a hint of contempt he had for himself. Allegedly, no girl on campus would date him, let alone invite him out to pledge. He wore no shoes, had his hair in a bunch, did not address his lisp, his speech impediment he had, which was addressable. And he was dirty, he was a hippie, and obviously did not consider his hygiene at all. He shows up at the prof's door, the speaker of this story, and says, "Hi, my name is Larry Mullaney, and I'm an agnostic." The prof replies, "Wow, really? I tell you what, Larry, if you become an atheist, I'll take you to dinner and we'll celebrate your conversion." I love that part. He's being cheeky. Larry responds back to that comment with a strange look. Anyways, that semester ends. Christmas time comes around. He goes back to Providence, Rhode Island to be with his parents. His father is a lace curtain Irishman, someone who apparently on the hottest day will insist on coming to the dinner table in his pinstripe suit, starch white shirt with a small knot at the top, never allowing his sideburns to go over his ears, and always speaking in a low, subdued Irish, shanty Irish voice. Apparently, Larry comes waddling up to the table, smelling like a billy goat, and his father and him have their number of quarrels and reconciliations, a typical vacation in the Mullaney household. One day, Larry says to his dad, "Dad, I gotta go to school tomorrow." "What time, son?" 6 a.m, Larry replies. "I'll ride down on the bus with you." At 6 a.m., they ride down on the bus together in silence to the airport. As they stand there, 6 men across the street standing under the awning who all work at the same textiles factory as Larry's father, they begin to say loud and degrading remarks like, "Oink, oink, oink, look at that fat pig, isn't he disgusting? All them hippies are the same, lazy, shiftless, immoral, unpatriotic. I tell you, if that slob was my kid, he'd be out the door so fast he wouldn't know if he was on foot or horseback. If that kid was mine, I'd bury him in the basement, I'd be so ashamed. Hey, pig, give us your loudest oink." These are the remarks of those 6 men. While these brutal remarks continued, Larry later told the prof and speaker of this story that for the first time, his father reached out and embraced him, kissed him on the lips, and said this line, which I love. This is the one that gets me in the story. He says, "Larry," and he says it in his Irish accent, which I won't try. He says, "Larry, if your mother and I live to be 300 years old, that won't be long enough to thank God for the gift we have in you. I am so proud that you are my son." The prof comments that he has no words to describe the change, the transformation that took place in Larry Mullaney. He returns to campus, remains a hippie, starts to clean up his act a bit, begins to date a girl, becomes the president of the TK Society fraternity, which I had to look that up. I'm still not entirely clear what it is, but apparently it's a big deal. He was the first student at the university to graduate with a 4.2 grade point average. He had a brilliant mind, but his insecurity was limiting him. One day, he walks up to the prof's office and says, "So, tell me about this Jesus guy of yours." The prof replies, "No." Larry shoots back, "Why?" "Not until you get rid of that lazy lip of yours. No reason you can't talk straight. Go up to the speech clinic up the street." Larry does this. He gets his act together a little bit in that department, which I don't think is a big deal. And I'm like scratching my head. Why did the prof care about that? Anyways, he comes back 3 months later, and the prof and him begin to meet for a half hour over the next weeks, talking about how Jesus had changed this prof's life, and how the Holy Spirit had been working in him, revealing these different things of how to live life abundantly. To make a long story short, on June 14th of 1974, 26-year-old Larry Mullaney totally sold out to Jesus, becoming a priest in the Diocese of Providence, Rhode Island. And I'm not going to take the credit for what this author says after this, but I think his insights about this story are so true. He says, "You know why? You know why Larry changed? Because his father healed him. His father had the guts to get out of his foxhole. He had the moxie to stand beside his son in the boundary moment of his life, refused to shout with a crowd across the street, looked deep into his son's eyes, affirmed him, and changed the complete direction of his life." I think Jesus chucked the wrench into the fear that Larry Mullaney had that was limiting his potential. And I think in that, his potential was exposed, and he started to work in it, entirely changing the trajectory of his life. Kind of similar to Zacchaeus. So just to be personal for a sec, to tell how all of this has made sense in my life, why I would even tell these stories. 2.5 years ago, I think Jesus kind of chucked the wrench into my life, adjusting my reality, showing me more about myself that I never would have imagined. I chose that this is 2.5 years ago, and not entirely me. I think I was being prompted kind of by what was happening in me, to let everything and anything out about how I was feeling about the things I've done to a friend. Not pretty things, but like dirty, dark, shameful things, things I would not want to say in front of a crowd. And I recall it as terrifying, confusing, and probably, and the feeling I actually really had was as if I bailed on my entire sense of security in that moment. This friend, after having spent those 2 years inviting me along into his life, he affirmed me and didn't push me away in that. He invited me deeper into friendship. It seems from these stories that I've heard and in my own experiences, there is something that meets us in those moments of spontaneity, whether it's Zacchaeus on the sycamore tree, that father stepping out of his comfort zone amidst those people's comments, and then my story that just on a whim of courage, I can't even make any sense of, I exposed this stuff, and I can't even take it to my own credit. But there was another moment, which was 2 days later. It was that all first went down on a Friday night, and this is a Sunday night. And I was laying in bed. I had spent the last 2 days kind of in that realm of having no security, and it sucked. But then while laying in bed, I heard, it wasn't necessarily a voice because it wasn't audible, but it was such a significant thought that it left an impression on my emotions, heart, and mind, that I was Zacchaeus or Larry Mullaney for a moment in front of Dad or God, who overlooked all my junk. Jesus met me where I was, overlooked my flaws, and was delighted that I was his. From that point onward, I felt like I plunged into something that Brennan Manning calls a love affair, but a furious one, where God is not okay with me feeling bad about myself or insecure. But in loving me, he made me lovable, freeing me from disliking myself. I felt like I was the kid, and God was my dad in that moment. And I think when you've tasted and seen kind of this dichotomy, you become unsatisfied in life if it doesn't meet at least this par That's a par that we're deserved, always. And I think that response that that God gives us is just a hint of the pain that's reverberating in God's gut when we are infringed upon in any way. That his gut is wrenched. That is, he's bothered deep inside him when his kids are infringed upon by something like fear or insecurity or whatever that can manifest itself into in our lives. And funny thing is that my mom is like this a lot. If I'm not feeling good, just emotionally or in a number of different capacities, her world comes to a crashing halt so that she can be there with me in that moment and sticks around during and after it, after I've sorted it out. And I think that is also just a hint of what God is like, that God is actually tender like that, where he does not second guess shoving a wrench into our fears to return us back to that atmosphere of a child, like what I've been seeing at Mission Central in this last week. That's his intention, to chuck a wrench into our fears by showing us our potential, making us feel like we're operating in an atmosphere of a child. So that's kind of my bit, but I find that these stories can kind of present themselves in introspective ways through the week that help me get by and to keep kind of working through some of those things that even 2.5 years ago, when I first started working through, they still kind of show up in my day-to-day. And so the one I'm asking myself this week, that I actually have to ask myself every day, is do I have fears that Jesus would actually chuck a wrench into, or do I have it all together? That can Jesus improve my reality? Like, does that potential exist? And another one I'm asking myself, is my concept of God one that is echoed in the stories of Jesus, where he's actually compassionate with us? Kind of like how my mom can be in those moments, but times whatever, 10 billion. So that's what I wanted to say today. And why don't I ask Dad, on the behalf of all of us, how he might want to step in into our realities and make some adjustments. So, Dad, thank you for just what you've done in the places in my life that sucked, and that you redeemed them in some ways. And I love that your intention is to continue to redeem them, to fix them, to make them less confusing, to give me courage in the ways that you actually want me to address it. And telling me to forget about the different fears that are just like straight up not true, and that I don't need to believe. And thank you that it's that intention's not just for me, but that you have lots of kids, and everyone is special, and you can't get over each and every one of them. So in your name, Dad, thank you for that.